sometimes when I'm in certain frames of mind, particularly on very hot days around the North Circular, I can feel time radiating off of pre-moulded concrete lintels.
Welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with John Rogers and Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that looks at the rich tradition of early 20th century topographical walking guides to London and the South East and what use they might be to us today.
They're kind of like inlet valves for some unmediated cosmic energy.
Each week, we'll be taking a trip through the pages of a different book as if we are on a wayward topographical ramble.
Because I know they're actually just technology, they're applied machinery, but they seem to me almost to be kind of like storage vats of regional memory.
Hello and welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, John Rogers, and my co-host Nick Papadimitriou. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
This is the first of what will be seven broadcasts in this series. In this first one, we'll be mapping out the terrain that we'll be covering in the coming shows as we look at the wonderful world of interwar topographical walking guides to the London interzonal areas. In this show, we'll also be talking about the themes that are raised by these books, how and why we came to be interested in them in the first place, and how we have used them in our walks and in our work. Firstly, Nick, what I think we should do, really, is explain what we mean by a topographical walking book, because it's not immediately apparent, is it, when you say a topographical walking book? People don't always know what that is. There's not a section in Borders for topographical books. Could you just tell us what you think of?
Well, John, essentially topography is really nothing more than the detailed study of place, an area or region or town, etc. And what we are thinking of here are books that guide people through areas, regions and towns, walking books. And also later on in the series we'll be looking at a couple of books that are local history books for areas, but that in effect can provoke people to study and examine that area.
That's a good point, Nick. I think as well, one of the things that's wonderful about these books and one of the things that leads us to them and makes them relevant is that, unlike Lonely Planet guides to the Amazon Basin, these are guides to places like Hounslow and Pinner. You know, and but what they do, these are places where people live and work, where we live and work today, but they are a way of re-experiencing a very familiar landscape and what is often a maligned landscape.
Well, several of the books we're going to be looking at date from the interwar period between 1918 and 39. Next week, for instance, we're going to be looking at Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London. At the time those books were written, places like Hounslow, Greenford or the hinterlands of Harrow were still rural, although suburbia was just beginning to approach. And as you know, you and I favour these slightly older topographic books because they've taken on a patina of time. When we walk around, for instance, Monk's Park near Wembley, which we'll be doing next week, it's one of the chapters in Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London. In a sense, part of the walk is an engagement with the walk that Maxwell took in 1927 when the book was published. Almost as if while we were walking in the area, Maxwell himself is looking out of the vegetation along the bank of the River Brent and staring at us as we decide how best to get to IKEA to buy meatballs and chips at the end of a rainy day's walk.
You'd never heard of a meatball before, had you? You were very familiar with the nomenclature of Maxwell's 1925 book, but you'd never heard of a meatball before. I think that was a great experience yesterday. And what is unavoidable as you walk through what would otherwise be, I think, as Will Self often says, an under-imagined, overlooked landscape, is you've got Maxwell's voice in your head. And when you walk in the Chilterns following SPB Mays, you have SPB Mays' voices in your head. But whilst you're walking through often a light industrial estate, that's the case, isn't it, Nick?
That's correct, John. I mean, just to backtrack, next week we'll be talking about Gordon S. Maxwell's Fringe of London. And
let's give another plug.
And we went out yesterday in the pouring rain to do some field recordings, visiting the area. Monk's Park is a small area down by the North Circular near Stonebridge Park. And we all got sopping wet and spent the day recording down there.
What I'd like to do in just a second is play a little audio clip from 1935. But the reason for that is that this to try and set the ground, really, that at the time, between the wars, I think most of these books are published between about 1925 and 1940. I think we do one book in this series, H.P. Clun's The Face of London, which is 1968, 69, something like that, Nick, isn't it?
No, the first edition was about 1952.
I knew you were going to contradict me at least once in this show. And then we got it out of the way nice and early. But these books were very much part of the culture in the interwar period. And I think the fact that Tommy Handley, who was the most popular music hall comedian of his day, I think it's fair to say, the fact that he could do a sketch based around the experience of following one of these guides is testimony to the fact that they were very popular in their day. So we'll just play a little clip from that film now from 1935.
Well, folks, excuse me being so thirsty. But as a matter of fact, I've been taking a walk. And if anybody else wants to take it, they can have it. I've finished with it. And it almost finished me, too. It was one of those walks you see advertised in the newspapers, complete with a map and all the wrong directions. You know the sort of thing I mean. An afternoon in Beachy Bucks, or gallivanting in Gravesend. Well, the one I've just taken was called A Pleasant Stroll in the Bunyan Country. Now, according to Public Enemy Number One, that's the fellow who writes about these walks, Hedgehog, I think he calls himself, you take the first train from Chatsby Junction and come home by bus. I should go home by ambulance. I followed his instructions as best I could, taking the left-hand turning past Peabody Buildings and passing the Dog and Dinner, the Jolly Brewer and the Three Blind Mice, because it was before opening time. I turned down by the gasworks. Now, something went wrong here, because I walked three times around the gasometer before I discovered that it wasn't a gasometer at all. It was Davy Burnaby and Teddy Brown having a chest-to-chest talk. Well, passing the glue factory and grasping my nose with the thumb and forefinger of the left hand, with the fingers extended fanwise in the direction of a local sewage farm, I stepped breezily past Smelby Soapworks until I reached the Corporation rubbish dump, on which was a notice, no parking here.
That's wonderful. So,
very good.
Tommy Handley, 1935. It does point out to me, actually, that reminds me that these books, they don't give very good directions either, and I think that's part of their charm, that if you were to follow them today, you'll get fairly lost. I think you'd have got fairly lost following them in 1935. I mean, there's one walk that I know particularly well, which is one of the Field Fair walks that goes from High Wycombe Station to Hedzer Wharf. That's in Buckinghamshire. And that route is hardly changed at all, actually, since that book was written about 1914, something like that, Nick. And the directions are absolutely rubbish. But that is one of the reasons why they become so useful for using today as a means of re-exploring the landscape, Nick. What do you think about that?
They vary book by book. And while it's true that you know, many things have changed, there's been a suburbia encroaching on the rural area around London, it's also astonishing how much has actually stayed the same. I found for myself with Field Fair that the descriptions are still valid. I took a walk from Ware to Bengeo Temple in East Hertfordshire and then down the River Lee to Hartford a few years ago, and I was able to duplicate exactly the walk that Field Fair gave. But, you know, I think also some of the books we'll be looking at, as I said earlier, will be provocations. And I think for anyone with as fine a nose for landscape as we've managed to develop in the last few years, don't really need point-to-point descriptions of where to go anyway. You develop a sensibility and an eye for the landscape, and you kind of guide yourself. It is interesting, though, to try and duplicate a walk as accurately as possible.
Yeah, that's one method. I think I think hopefully there'll be a little bit of take home from these shows if you're interested, or take out, not really take home. But we will be talking about the ways that we've used these books to provoke walks. And I made a documentary film about Nick and his practice recently called The London Perambulator, which is screening at Cine City in Brighton on the 26th of November. Got that plug in there seamlessly, didn't I? They didn't sound crude at all. One thing with these books, Nick, and I think you and I both came at this from the same angle, and that's how we met, really. It was over a shared love of Gordon S. Maxwell's The Fringe of London. That's the fourth time we've mentioned that, fifth time in the first 10 minutes of the show. But it was really, for me and for you, it came about because of a love of walking. And these books, I found in these books, that they express a sensibility which was closer to the way that I experienced walking. And that I didn't really see in a lot of contemporary literature. I think you see it in the writing of Ian Sinclair and you see it in Will Self. I hadn't really seen it anywhere else. Sort of a little bit with the Beats. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to read a little excerpt that illustrates this sensibility and how it elevates it beyond the kind of walking guide you might see in a Sunday supplement. This is from Chiltern Footpaths by Ann Dixon, and this is one of the sort of first books of this type that I came across. And most of these walks originate in High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire, which is also where I originate. And hence, I came to this book whilst doing a psychogeographical project, remapping the town. So he talks about how through walking, you can actually be in the landscape rather than on it or through it, as you might be by other means of locomotion, and on level terms with humanity and nature. And then he says, "Grant this, and it can be argued that walking is one method, and a very fine one, of letting nature work her sweeting influence on such humanity as chooses to lay itself open to the process. And from that, it is one step farther, but a fundamental one, to submit that thither lies the way to a realization of the unity which underlies the universe." Now, bear in mind, that is from a walking book about High Wycombe. And it is, you know, it's profound, isn't it? You have a similar experience with this.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, I started consciously walking, if you like, in about 1987. And I found very soon after I began walking, the first guides I used were London Transport published guides from the 1970s. I found very early on that walking for me was a lot more than just walking across a landscape of discrete objects and passing through towns and looking at a few old buildings and gaining knowledge of worthies who lived in certain country houses. Much as I like all of those things, I found that when I walked, I was beginning to experience something that could only be described as an alteration of my consciousness. And that when I walked out of Hampstead, for instance, and walked into the Green Belt, I literally walked out of the Hampstead Head as well and walked into something that was a deeper stratum of my consciousness. I would call it a deep topographic sensibility. I think like many people nowadays, though, I might feel slightly suspicious about the organic unity that's referred to in that article, in that piece that you just read. It rests uneasily with me somewhere. I like landscapes of conflict and difficulty as well. I like, although the writers from the 30s often complain about aerodromes or arterial roads, I actually like features like that in the landscape. For me, they've become almost as natural as oak forests and beech woods and old Saxon hedges, etc. Where I experience the enemy is perhaps the kind of building boom that's currently going on around London and the loss of the brownfield sites, sites that I was always immensely fond of, spontaneous little ecosystems replaced by orange brick houses with dishes on the side. I often suspect myself of a sort of closet classism when I feel the contempt I have for them. But there it is. I just think, you know, couldn't we just have less people and more brownfield sites? It would be much nicer.
Yeah, that's nice. The artist, Bob and Roberta Smith, who also has a show on Resonance FM on a Friday night called Make Your Own Damn Music. Bob's an artist and sculptor, and he refers to fly tipping as unofficial sculpture. I really like that. You've got quite a sort of psychedelic sensibility, I think. For someone, I'm quite straight, really, in a lot of ways. And you bring something else to this that I'd not encountered elsewhere, hence I ended up making a film about you. You are like a psych... I know I pitched you to the BBC once as the psychedelic Wainwright, perambulating both the margins and marginalia of Middlesex. Can you shed a little bit of light on how you came to have that view of suburbia? There's a little example. There's a few examples of it in the intro clip to this show, where you talk about time radiating off pre-moulded concrete lintels, storage vats of regional memory, inlet valves for unmediated cosmic energy. These are not usually the kind of associations people have with the North Circular.
Well, you do have this habit of following me around with a microphone and ask me to say something profound. And I often come out with things such as storage vats of regional memory and inlet valves for noumenal energy that underlies the stockbroker belt and all the rest of it. And I get this curious double take. I think, Nick's being witty, and perhaps he's sort of like, bullshitting slightly. But then I think about it afterwards and I think, well, I experience something and I experience it again and again and again. And when I come back into the city and I get into my sort of the drudgery of my daily life, I begin to deny what I've experienced. And then when I go out again, I confront it again and think, no, it's here. And really, all that storage vat of regional memory and inlet valves for noumenal energy underlying the stockbroker belt are an attempt at expressing that. It's a very hard thing to pin down. I think, you and I and people in our kind of age wave, we belong to a post-war electronic generation. And I think that really we're not that different to people like Gordon S. Maxwell and Field Fair and Pathfinder and other people who wrote country books in the 1920s and 30s. I think that the sensibility, the way the individual sees themselves has changed. We see ourselves far more as kind of like channels for energy that flows through us. We're far more shamanic and psychedelic, and perhaps we've got more of an element of social criticism and suspicion of the language of power than people had in those days. And I think that kind of manifests in some of the writing that I've done, for instance, on my website, middlesexcountycouncil.org.uk.
Another plug in there. Also, I think we should give a plug for the fact that one of the best examples of that writing is the essay you wrote in Ian Sinclair's anthology, London City of Disappearances, which is about Bedfont Court Estate over near Heathrow, isn't it? And it sits very well within that anthology. I thought that anthology of writing, actually, some of that is in tune with the topographical tradition we're talking about. Do you agree with that?
Well, the interesting thing about Bedfont Court Estate is that it's just off the western end of Heathrow Airport, down Spout Lane North off the Western Perimeter Road, if you want to find your way there. If you're heading south, just turn right by the dog kennels. And it's actually got quite a history of appearing in topography books. It's in A Foot Around London by Pathfinder, 1909. I wrote my chapter in Ian Sinclair's anthology, London City of Disappearances, but Sinclair walks within 100 yards or so of it in London Orbital. And Will Self's new book, Psycho 2, his second volume of psychogeography essays, he also walks within a couple of hundred yards of it as well. So we're all kind of like, everyone's hanging round there now, and, it's getting a bit crowded down at Bedfont Court Estate, in my opinion.
We'll talk about your feelings about the psychogeographical fraternity a little bit later. Next, I'd like to play another little clip in a mo about you have an unbelievable collection of these books. It easily trumps mine. I have merely two shelves on my bookshelf. You have a room of them. Your collection is called Deep Library, which is also our email address. You can email us about this show at deeplibrary@yahoo.com. I won't say too much, Nick, before we play the clip, but just to, so you've got this amazing collection. We're going to play this little clip of when I first visited your Deep Library about 2 years ago, exactly 2 years ago, actually, when I first came to Deep Library, and we'll talk about it after this little clip now.
Here's some good Deep Library. County Sketches for City Dwellers, William Rawnsley. Rural Nooks Around London.
Great book.
The Open Book of Nature.
Where did you find it?
In a skip. Ealing Local History Society, Greenford, The Historical Geography of a Northwest London Parish by K.A. Smalley. Members Papers Number 3, June 1963. It has a variety of maps. Look how low-grade the technology was in those days. It shows things like demographics within the county, people moving from agriculture to industry and industrial housing, the watersheds, types of land, drainage and irrigation. Very, very useful book. Very proud to have found that. Proud is quite the right word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
This is a crucial document. It's a brief history of Hendon College of Technology, 1939 to 1972. Apparently, it includes a serious error concerning the positioning of a pond in Hendon. Oh, the Druitt books, Harrow, Pinner and the Stanmores Through the Ages, by W.W. Druitt. I mean, just his name, he deserves to be canonised as a topographer, don't you think? I like those stiff old wire-framed glasses names, the people we used to sneer at in the 1970s. I think that they're our real cultural heroes. I love them very much.
So what defines Deep Library?
What, location-wise in the room?
So you say that isn't Deep Library, but this is. What defines what goes into Deep Library?
The Deep Library is the printed form of the storage vat of regional memory. It's actually the written aspect of it, to which I am adding in turn, and I will show you later how I am contributing to Deep Library. Mm. But Deep Library isn't that locatable. I've got a kind of a major sort of synapse zone of the Deep Library, but actually you may find it in skips or in garages elsewhere in Middlesex or even beyond Middlesex. And I suspect there's other people who've got other sections of the Deep Library. Probably people who sort of sneer at me when I go walking around Hounslow and think I'm some kind of upstart psychogeographer rather than somebody who's actually been doing this for years.
Thus spake Zarathustra.
That was you can see a little bit of that on YouTube. Actually, that's a bit of audio from a video. I just took my camcorder to Nick's house. If you put Deep Library in YouTube, funnily enough, only one video comes up with Deep Library in the title, and it's that one of you. In terms of, we cover it a little bit there about how this material can be used. I mean, for me, just to put a little bit of contrast in at this stage, I very much came at these books as a practical tool whilst working on a project which was inspired by psychogeography in my hometown of High Wycombe on a public art project that was based around a response to a town centre redevelopment. And we did a series of derives, and we used these books as material to instigate derives. Through the course of the project, we found that these books probably have more to say about our Chilton's town than did Guy Debord and the Situationists in France in the 50s. You there very clearly distance yourself from psychogeography, and psychogeography is a bit more of a familiar term to people at this stage than deep topography, although you're on a one-man crusade to reverse that. Could you just briefly point out for you what the contrast is between deep topography and psychogeography?
I don't really know much about psychogeography. My friend Will Self is interested in it. Obviously, I've contributed to Ian Sinclair's book. I've heard of Guy Debord or whatever his name is and stuff like that. But I'm, as you know, I'm a deeply antisocial and unfriendly person, and I just don't really have that kind of engagement with something that's contemporary in the culture. For me, walking always took me on the spin-out beyond what was going on in the cafes and the art galleries in Hampstead and Camden. And it was a time that was quite difficult for me, actually, because a career I'd been working on had collapsed shortly before I started walking, and there was a sort of wounded pride that was operating. I was like some old lion who'd been torn up in one too many fights, licking my wounds in the hedges of Zone 6, and I just started developing my own ideas, pretty much in isolation, and I began to buy books from junk shops and from second-hand bookshops about the areas that I studied, but I had no real sense of anything called psychogeography that was going on. I must admit some of our somewhat playful contempt I show for psychogeography is a little bit of pride, but I think some of it's tongue-in-cheek as well. I don't mean to offend anyone or anything like that.
I think what's interesting is that over the course, I suppose, since I've known you, we started doing these little videos explaining what you think and believe. Other people have come to the conclusion as well, in a way, that deep topography or a practice based on English topographical walking guides in a lot of ways does feel more relevant to re-experiencing the suburban areas of England than the more sort of coldly intellectual approach taken by the situationists. But I think there is definitely a crossover, I think, and I think interesting. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, so if I get it wrong, please forgive me. But my sort of historical rendering is that the situationists in France in the 50s were sort of inspired by or responding to or critiquing what the surrealists had been up to earlier on, and the surrealists had engaged in a sort of a program of walks, which in themselves were inspired by English topographical practice and English pedestrianism. So there sort of it joins the ends up for me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to play a little audio clip, actually, of really the godhead of British and, I would say, international psychogeography, Ian Sinclair, talking about psychogeography and you.
Well, I like Nick's term deep topography very much. I mean, so much so that I've stolen it straight away as a way of avoiding this term psychogeography, because psychogeography was becoming a rather nasty brand name, I felt, and I felt some guilt for having brought this about. It had an authentic status in the 1960s when it was connected to situationism and to a way of aggressively dealing with the city, and then it drifted off into a kind of no man's land until I thought Stuart Home rescued it with his London Psychogeographical Association, in which the thing was activated again into present concerns and had a kind of comedy aspect to it as well. And then it really, really got into the popular mind as a way of describing almost anything to do with cities. Any activity or anything to do with walking became psychogeography. And Nick clearly challenged this terminology and brought in deep topography, which makes it seem more like that very British tradition of the naturalist, the walker at the edges of the city, the liminal figure who does all of that and who is not so conceptual in his practice. And I thought this is therefore a very, very useful term, and I'd like to use it myself. I have signed up to deep topography and abdicated from psychogeography immediately on hearing this term.
Well, that is quite clear and conclusive. There's the great Ian Sinclair renouncing psychogeography in favour of your little practice, deep topography, dreamed up in a council flat in Child's Hill near Golders Green. You must have been chuffed by that, Nick.
Enormously, and slightly embarrassed as well. I wonder sometimes if my deep topography isn't really just topography and my deep library isn't really just a library. And it's down to the magic mushrooms I took in my 1920s that I prefix it with the word deep.
I'm glad you brought up the mushrooms there, because over the coming weeks we will be taking a walk from each of a selection of topographical walking guides to London and the South East, a different author, a different book each week, and a different walk each week with a film recording. And next week's The Fringe of London, you do hear Nick talking about his experiences on magic mushrooms out in Monk's Park and Middlesex. And the week after that, we're doing a walk. What's the week after that, Nick?
We're going to the Cuffley Hills and to Enfield Chase using Pathfinder's book, A Foot Around London, 1909, special centenary celebration.
And then we are also doing SPB Mazes, It Isn't Far From London, Harold P. Klun's The Face of London, and
T.H. Bartlett's History of Roxeth, which is South Harrow.
And also, and finally, James T. Bones, The London Perambulator, which gave us the name of the film About You. I think that's about all we've got time for this week. Thanks for listening to Ventures and Adventures in Topography on Resonance 104.4 FM.